A grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Imagine yourself as a young child in the car with your family. You're on your way to a party, but there's an accident, and it takes the lives of your father and a baby sister. Tayari Jones's new novel, The Untelling, is a story of grief and recovery, a coming-of-age story. It is described as speaking of the circumstances that can either undermine or restore us, and the transformative power of examining all that we keep untold. Tayari Jones is our guest this afternoon. She's an assistant professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. In addition to The Untelling, she is the author of the novel Leaving Atlanta. That book involves the murders of African-American children in Atlanta that began in the summer of 1979. And the story of that time is told through the voices of children. Both books, The Untelling and Leaving Atlanta, are published by Warner. Listeners, I invite you to join the conversation this afternoon with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Professor Jones was on the program in April for a shorter interview. We had to postpone this longer discussion because she had almost no voice in the midst of a book tour, no less. She came down with laryngitis, and I'm pleased to have her back this afternoon today in full voice. Welcome back. Good to see you again.
Thanks for having me.
To be a writer on a book tour without a voice, that had to be maddening.
You know, it brought me, it's almost like everything on the book tour takes you back to every adolescent anxiety you ever had. You know, just like the idea of breaking out before the prom or finally getting your big book tour and you can't talk. It's like I had to really just calm down and remember, it made me remember that being a writer is not about going on tour and signing autographs. It's about really what I do alone. And I felt like it was kind of a wake-up call from above.
But it's got to feel good to have a project done and then be able to go out. And I imagine that this is now your second novel, so
yes.
You run into people who read you.
Yes, this time on my second book tour, there were actually people in the audience who had read the book. With the first book, I felt as though I was begging people to give me a chance. And this time, there were people who had read the book. I had to stop them from spoiling it for the other people. And that was really terrific. That was the most rewarding thing.
Okay. Well, we'll try not to spoil the story here this afternoon either.
You're a pro, Celeste. I know it'll be fine.
You know, in both of these books, in Leaving Atlanta and The Untelling, you use the child's point of view, and you do it very effectively. I mean, the main character, the narrator, and the protagonist in The Untelling is an adult, but she goes back and remembers very clearly.
I like writing children's points of view because, one, I feel that we can't really understand the adults we are without remembering the children that we were. And the child's point of view is such an interesting way to show the world because you can make things that are very ordinary and familiar to us as adults unfamiliar. And when you make things unfamiliar, it's when you really see how they are. And also, I just enjoy it. Some people say they're writing from the child's point of view is so difficult. But I think that the key to writing the child's point of view is to try to remember children the way they seem to other children. You know, children do not find one another to be cute. And so when you write, you know, like those your little friends in third grade, you weren't like, oh, look at us, we're so cute. You found them horrifying or beautiful or what you felt about them, whatever you feel about your peers now. And that's the key for me to capturing that voice is remembering if anything starts seeming cute, my advice to any writer would be throw it away and start over.
Yeah. Why did you choose the child murders of Atlanta as the subject for your first novel?
Well, with Leaving Atlanta, I was a child in Atlanta during the child murders. I was in the fifth grade, and I had sort of forgotten about the experience. I think forgotten isn't the right word. It's like I had to repress it. Like my whole generation, we had to repress this experience. And when I was in college, at Spelman College, I used to babysit a little boy, and he showed up a little late, and I had something very close to a panic attack, although I didn't know that word, panic attack. And I realized it's because I had lived through these child murders. And so when the little boy was late, it freaked me out, and I didn't know why. And then I realized this great kind of injustice that had been done into my generation, that we can't talk about this thing that was so central to our growing up.
Yeah. When you came in this afternoon and sat down next to me, we talked a little bit, and you told me that they're reopening this case.
Yes, in DeKalb County. Atlanta is Fulton County and DeKalb County, and the DeKalb County police chief is opening all the cases that happened in DeKalb County, and it's six cases, and there's been no evidence, new evidence, but he was just never satisfied, and I think he's a voice of a certain community there, because Wayne Williams, who was arrested for the child murders, was charged with the murders of two adults, and they closed the cases on all the children. So we never found out what happened. We don't know if Wayne Williams is guilty or not, and so there was no transparency. And just imagine this. In 1981, they said they convicted him based on fiber evidence, like lint and stuff. So this is a community that has no reason to have faith in law enforcement, and they say, we've caught the guy, but the evidence can only be seen by our scientists. You just have to take our word for it. And that did not give the community the information they would have needed to heal.
Yeah. How does the community, how does Atlanta feel about the reopening of the case?
People are torn. I mean, I wrote an op-ed in the Atlanta paper last week stating that I think it's good that they're reopening the cases, but others, people say that it's opening old wounds, but because Atlanta was so torn about this. But I don't think it's opening old wounds, because that wound was never healed. It was more like a bone improperly set. And, you know, if the bone isn't set right, it'll never heal. And the only way to fix it is to break it again and set it right. And I think that's what's going to have to happen in Atlanta.
Hmm. You talked about being in the fifth grade in Atlanta at this time. And being then a little older and feeling this onset of panic when this little boy showed up a little late for you when you were going to babysit him. What else do you remember about that time, being in grade school and living through this?
I remember, well, one thing to think about, too, is that for me this was fifth grade. This is when the differences between boy and girl were starting to count more. And then only the boys were being abducted. There were two girls, but I think people decided later that it wasn't quite in the pattern. But they were, so only the boys were getting abducted. And I had all these strange feelings. I had an older brother who's kind of like the hero of my family. And then here I was, a girl, kind of female, invisible, but safe. So I had that kind of guilt. Then I had a kind of irrational, almost resentment, because the idea was that the boys were being murdered because they were such a threat to the power structure, whatever that meant. And then I felt like a girl, like almost, this is going to sound kind of weird, but almost like you weren't worth killing, like you weren't a target, because who are you, you know? And I had all these kind of feelings going on at once. And then also I realized that most of the kids who were being killed were from Atlanta's lower income neighborhoods. And then I learned that the fact that my dad lived with us, that we had a certain level of economic security, nothing lavish, but I learned that it was enough to keep you safe. And that really changed the whole way I saw the world from that then forward.
Hmm. Both novels are set in Atlanta, your hometown, and you've said your imagination lives in Atlanta. Would you talk about that?
Well, you know, most of the stories I write are set in Atlanta, and it is because Atlanta, for me, has a lot of things that shows us where the rubber hits the road in our nation. It's kind of like in the Midwest, how like the Midwest is known for agrarian culture, but there are cities. You know, Atlanta's in the South, which is known for kind of a rural lifestyle. And then there's a city. So it's kind of the best. It's kind of an intersection of worlds. And also in Atlanta, in the neighborhood where I set the Untelling, you have a block that is in the middle of gentrification. And this part of town, since I was a little girl, people have been saying it's on the rise. And it hasn't risen, but a little bit. So you have really rich people living here who've been able to buy a house and refabulize it, shall we say. And then people who buy in because that's what they can afford. And then people who are almost homeless who are squatting in the abandoned houses. And so for this brief moment, you have all of America living on the same block.
Yeah. I spent a couple of days in Atlanta, 1988. And it had that feeling to me at the time. Great wealth, great poverty.
And it's still that way. It really is that way. And only on rare spaces do the two come together. And really the people who live on the margins, in between parts are what are most interesting to me. So in the Untelling, Aria, she is a lower middle class person. So she can then talk to the people who she teaches adult literacy. So she has some things in common with her students who are a lower income, but also she can also relate, for lack of a better word, I'll say relate to her roommate, Rochelle, who's planning a $50,000 wedding. So she's the mediator. And those are the characters that are most interesting to me because I feel that we can understand the way worlds work when we see people have one foot in each.
Yeah. Is that why you made her a student of sociology?
I did. And also, it just seemed like she's curious about people and sociology major. She says she's a sociology major in college. It's kind of a major, too, that a lot of people go in when they don't know what to go into. You know, like people who are music majors, it's because music is their heart. And sociology wasn't her heart, but she felt that because of her personality, it's something that she could do a decent job at.
Yeah. And she sees herself as just an ordinary person, but I find her an extraordinary character.
Yes, she sees herself as ordinary, and even the fact that she can see herself as ordinary is a testament to her strength that she can see herself as average in light of what she's experienced. You know, it means that she's kind of actually inflated what her self-image could have been. But yes, she's a lot more, like many of us, she's a lot more resilient than she gives herself credit for, and she doesn't give herself very much credit for her kindness. I think what makes her special is her kindness, and she doesn't even think of that as attributes. It's just life.
Yeah. We see her at different points in her life, a little girl at the outset, a student at Spelman, and as a young woman, a teacher. To what extent did you draw on your life experiences to create Aria? Because you went to Spelman.
I did go to Spelman, and it was very important to me that I put Spelman in the novel. I hadn't ever seen Spelman in a novel except for that one novel by Alice Walker, which doesn't call Spelman by name, and it's not a very flattering portrait. The novel is called Meridian. And I wanted to, that's a world that I really know that I haven't seen. And I do think that often, I mean, Spelman is a historically black women's college in Atlanta that is kind of famous for having kind of what we would call bourgeois students. And quite often I see that part of the black middle class portrayed either to be parodied like in a Spike Lee film or in this kind of classist exaltation, you know, like in some more other books like this book, Our Kind of People. And I just kind of wanted to just give a more objective, nuanced portrait of that kind of world.
Hmm. I remember from our last conversation that you, like Aria, found the early days of college pretty intimidating.
Well, when I went to Spelman, I was 16, and I wasn't the only one who was 16. It's like before you go there, you think that you're the most, you think you're such an outstanding person, and you find that everyone there is outstanding, and you have to think of another way to stand out other than the way that you thought. And what Aria does is she tries to be useful. She's going to stand out by learning to type so she can type people's papers. You know, like she's trying to figure out a way to be remarkable amongst the remarkable.
Hmm. And she copes in part by drawing up a list.
Yeah, she's got
rules.
This funny list of things she wants to accomplish. Like one is stop being so weird. Another is do something decent. Make friends with someone you admire. Because, you know, when you think about it, when you start college, it's your time to try again. It's all new. No one knows who you were in high school, what you did. It's your chance, or so you feel.
Yeah, and you're without your family. You're really on your own.
Yes, You could change your name. You know there are people who go to college and change their names.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I had a classmate who was Tracy. We always called her Tracy. And she went away to Mount Holyoke and started calling herself Anjanae.
Whoa.
Who knew?
You know, one of the rules that Aria starts out with is be known for something decent. And then that comes around to do something decent.
Yeah, you know, she has a change. Yeah, she wants to be known for something decent because she thinks what she wants to do is to stand out. But it does. It comes down to her deed. And it makes me think of when my grandmother passed away many years ago, there was only one person at her funeral who was old enough to have known her as a person, like as a peer. And it was an elderly lady, and she sang what she said was my grandmother's hymn, which the lyrics were, "Let the work I've done speak for me." And I remember that. I was so moved by that moment at that funeral because this was the only person who knew my grandmother. And this person spoke of her deeds. And I had that in mind when I was working with this novel. And I wanted to bring that theme back. What have you done? What have you done?
Hmm. And there's transformation happening throughout this novel. And I would like for you to read from The Untelling. When we begin to see this transformation from be known for something decent to do something decent, and I think it begins on page 60.
Ah,
I've marked
yes.
it there for you.
Yes, you have.
And would you do us the kindness of reading that passage?
Okay. Let me see if there's anyone that you need to know. Aria has a sister, Hermione, who married their father's best friend when she finished high school. They wanted to get out of the house, to say the least. I think back to times like that, and it's as though I'm watching a movie about myself. It makes me feel like I'm getting old because I can now look at my younger self like she was a different person from who I am now. I will often find myself wanting to go back and whisper into my own ear, explaining the things that once confused me. I wish I could have told myself how things were going to turn out. There are many ways to get old, to ripen. Hermione was just past 18 when she got married, and she became a grown woman in less than a week. I saw her just 3 days after she'd run away, and she was older already. Her extra weight didn't seem like plump, tight baby fat anymore. She looked like a woman who had had 2 or 3 kids. She looked like her body had been used for something. I've aged just this month. In a single morning, I retched over the toilet and realized that I was pregnant. It's not the pregnancy itself that was the milestone, but how pleased and satisfied I was to realize it. The news zipped through me like something fast and shiny. I'd spent the last decade worrying about the possibility that a baby may take root in my body. Maybe the fact that I can say I've been doing anything for a decade says something, too, about aging.
Hmm. From The Untelling, Tayari Jones's new novel. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. You know, this main character, this protagonist, she is a person really with a good moral compass, isn't she?
You know, I think that she is, which is so funny because, you know, there's some times when she's not as forthright as she could be. You know, she hides things kind of in self-preservation mode. But I do think that at the heart of her, she's a very moral person and she tries to do unto others. And she understands that things are not fair, that wealth, goods, all kinds of gifts are not distributed equitably, and she's working very hard to try and level the playing field.
Yeah. What role does faith, religion, play in your writing?
You know, it comes up a lot in my writing, and it's probably because I was not reared with any formal religious background. I know my father is like the one black atheist in the world. It's my dad. He's like a Marxist when I was growing up. It was like a big thing. Like my mother has since, my parents are both preacher's children. So my father is, he's a special case. He's an atheist son of a preacher. That's a special stripe. And my mother has had a conversion. So she's very, very devout now. So I kind of was reared between these two and trying to negotiate then what do I think about it? And when I think about my child characters in both my books, I think about the way that Christianity has taught to children and all these really scary stories and the way that they try to apply these. And so much of it, as I was taught, was punitive for my grandparents, because both my grandparents were preachers, mm-hmm. you know, this kind of punitive way. And one thing I try to look at in the book is in what is trying to kind of come to a kind of level of faith where it becomes doing what is right for one's own spiritual edification, but not this kind of do what's right or you go to hell. Do what's right because it's right, because it's right.
Hmm. Last time you were here, we were finished with the interview, and I said to you, I'll never look at a dogwood tree the same way. In The Untelling, at the outset of the book, Aria is telling the story of the dogwood in the car before the accident. Where did you hear that story? And tell us about the symbolism of the dogwood in the story.
The story of the dogwood trees. I learned this when I was a child. I grew up in Georgia. And, you know, the separation of church and state in Georgia, they're like, what's that? So in school, I learned the story that the dogwood tree, what we learned is that the dogwood was once as mighty as the oak and pine, and that the wood from the dogwood was used to make the crucifix. And because of this, the dogwood is so ashamed that it's now a small and gnarled tree. And if you look at a dogwood blossom, we have some here in Champaign, you'll see there's a little dark spot on each of the blossoms. And as Aria said, that's the blood, so nobody could forget about Jesus. So the idea is that the plant has stigmata. And this idea of this guilt remaining with you over a lifetime and changing your body, your actual structure, this goes throughout because as Aria and her family are in the accident, they're on their way to a party, but she's reciting her Easter speech about the dogwood. So it's about guilt and how it stays with you and how it marks you. Mm. That's one of those childhood stories that I didn't like, that I got, you know, in vacation Bible school when my grandparents were trying to, like, give us religion over the summer before we went back to our parents, you know.
How did your parents and your grandparents negotiate all this territory?
Well, you know, one thing that was is that because my father was a PhD and was quite successful, you know, he grew up picking cotton, and then he ended up being a PhD, that he was given some slack. And also because my father is a very good and kind person. He's the go-to person if someone has a crisis. So I think my grandparents are kind of hoping that, I don't know, that he'll be given some kind of spiritual pass for his deeds, for his good work. But in the summer, yeah, they would look at their watch, say, we have 1 month to get some faith in these children.
Do you think there's any hope that he'll, like your mom, see the light?
I doubt
so
it.
So to speak? No. Yeah.
I think it's such a part of his identity. And he's also, once again, very much on that deed. And it's something, a question that I've always wondered, you know, like, does it matter if you do the right thing, but not for the right reason? I mean, that's the ongoing debate he has with his siblings, that he feels that he lives what would be called a Christian life.
Hmm.
But he doesn't go to church.
Yeah. That's the same kind of thing that Aria is grappling with in The Untelling.
Yes, it is. Like, yes, what, yeah, does it matter? If you do the right thing, does it matter why?
Yeah. Well, it's like somebody, you know, it's like the idea of doing a good deed and then telling everybody about it.
Yes, yes. And what about the performance of goodness? Yeah, is it to be performed? How does goodness matter in the way that we perceive ourselves and others? You know, it's a kind of complicated book, but I will say, because I think that sometimes when I'm talking about this book, you know, because there's so much loss and crises of faith, et cetera, in the book, that I should tell people it's also a little bit funny. Because it's a little bit funny to be alive. And I feel if you write a novel and nothing funny happens, you haven't captured life.
Mm. Mm. Well, this book and the earlier one, Leaving Atlanta, really good reads. And they're good reads just from the outset with the acknowledgments, Tyara.
Well, you know, my books both have long acknowledgments. But I tell myself how fortunate and blessed I am to have so many people to acknowledge. I mean, by the time you get a book out, so many people have lent a hand and helped. And I try to acknowledge every single one of them. And I've been told that it doesn't look sophisticated to have such long acknowledgments pages. You know, must you thank the lady who kept your P.O. box when you were out of town? And I say, yeah, because if it wasn't for the support, I never would have written the book. So I thank them all.
Yeah, yeah. And we know that You love your family like a bunch of grapes. That's wonderful. This is the Afternoon Magazine writer Tyari Jones, our guest this afternoon. She's an assistant professor of English at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She is the author of two novels, The Untelling and Leaving Atlanta, both books published by Warner Books. And they're also available, at least The Untelling, I know, is now or will be shortly available in an audio.
Yes, they're both actually available in audio, but I didn't do my own audio. They say that the author doing her own audio is a kiss of death.
Yeah, it can be hard work.
And also, they hire actors.
Actors. Mm-hmm.
But they are both available in audio. I haven't heard either of them. I feel it would weird me out.
Yeah. Well, it's funny, when last time when you were here and you had laryngitis, I thought, well, maybe we could do the longer interview if I had the audio version, and we could just
patch it in,
and then I went to look for it. It wasn't available yet.
Oh, so. I think it's out now.
It's out now. I think it was coming out in June. So here we are, June 2nd. Very good. Listeners, if you'd like to join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. We've got a listener joining us this afternoon now, a caller in Indiana on line 4. Good afternoon.
Hello. I guess the rule's still true that if you listen long enough to the talk shows on WILL, somebody will show up who's got some expertise that can possibly answer a question.
Well, let's try it.
Here we go. When I was in as an undergraduate, well, as a graduate student too, come to think of it, but I had a few friends who were English majors, and I remember this would have been in the good old 60s. That there was sort of an undercurrent in the coffee houses and all that kind of stuff, that English professors or English teachers, and, you know, back then we basically were talking about men, but not always, but usually men, make terrible authors, and that the only kind that really count are the guys that we associate with, let's say, you know, the Hemingway group and stuff like that, where they move about and rarely do they do any, you know, teaching in terms of professional teaching. And I just wondered if, along that lines, is sort of what you might say about that. I, you know, just for thinking myself, I could see having input from students might be, you know, a very nice way to, you know, help guide your own creativity and things like that. I just wondered if you would talk to that a bit.
Well, you know, one thing I think about teaching and writing at the same time is that teaching writing causes me to constantly think about writing. And so that keeps it on my mind. I'm thinking about my work every day. I don't get distracted because I'm talking about writing all the time. And also on a more practical, I mean, I know they have this kind of, yeah, the romantic thing about the real writer is the one who is somewhere working at night, drinking all day and writing in this like vodka haze. But I find for me that my writing is so much better when I don't have to worry about my health insurance or where I'm going to live, et cetera. So I think that only people who think that it's kind of cute to be impoverished are people who've never really been impoverished.
Yeah. Well, I think Saul Bellow taught writing, didn't he?
Well, lots of people do now. Yeah. I mean, but there is that thought. There is that split where they say teaching will be the death of your writing. But it hasn't happened to me. And maybe there are some people who can't juggle both. But I really think working nights in a factory would be a lot harder on me. I mean, teaching gives you a lot of time to work on what you're going to work on. But it is kind of romantic. I do sometimes have the urge, you know, to put on the beret and go drink a lot of coffee and, you know, pontificate in public places.
Yeah. Now, the caller also kind of mentioned students, and do they influence your work? Do they give you ideas? How does that?
They don't exactly give me ideas. I try to make sure that I let them have their ideas. I think it
sure.
kind of undermines
yeah.
the workshop if you think your teacher is like, "Ooh, that's really interesting," you know, and taking notes for her own work. But working with them helps me, because when I'm constantly explaining concepts, it makes me have to think more what I think about the concepts. And I'm kind of youngish, so they challenge me. What if? What if? What about? And having to answer their questions, it really helps me. And I've got some fantastic students at U of I. I mean, I feel like we've really got something going here that's good.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I would also think that when you're in front of a classroom and those students can be so challenging, they can help you sharpen your own ideas.
They can. Mostly, yeah, they just help me get better on craft, because also I have to help them with their work, and in diagnosing their work teaches me more about what I'm doing.
Hmm.
Like, before I started teaching, I was not aware of what happens when you use too much dialogue. But my students do it a lot, so now I'm ultra sensitive to it in my own work. Yeah, you start using too much dialogue and your book starts to taste like a movie. And a book is different than a movie, so it can't mimic a screenplay.
Hmm. Well, let's go back to the untelling. Aria, her given name is Ariadne.
Yes.
And she's one of three girls, and we've mentioned Hermione in passing. She is one of three girls, the daughters of Eloise and Lincoln Jackson. So it's Ariadne, it is Hermione, and Genevieve.
Yes.
Eloise insists on big names for the girls. Why?
You know, I think people show their ambition in how they name their children. I mean, our parents, frankly, kind of named the hell out of us. My older brother, his name is Patrice Lumumba, although he goes by Patrice now, sometimes like P. But they named us with the ambition that you can see what they had in mind for us by their names. I think you can tell so much about people's parents by their names. I think you can't tell a lot about a person because usually you don't get to name yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But you can really see what their parents had in mind for them. And so Eloise, she sees giving her children these names, Ariadne, Hermione, Genevieve, as what civil rights has given her, the right to name her children in such a way that she thinks will be big. And even Keisha, the unwed mother in a GED class, she wants to give her child a name that makes people think he'll be successful. So she names him Wellington, you know? So, that's what people do. You name your children what you want them to have. It is Ariadne calls her mother's gifts, and that her mother does see herself giving her children a gift. But like most kids, including me, my mother gave me this name, and when I was a child, I wanted my name to be changed to Tasha. I thought that was a great name.
Now, what does Tayari mean?
It means she is prepared. And that kind of gives you a feeling, yeah, for what my parents are very kind of sturdy people. My dad was a Marxist at the time, so, you know, just, she will do it. Nothing, no flourishes, no, you know, butterfly nesting in a tree. No, she is prepared.
Yeah. Well, you introduce us to these wonderful characters right from the get-go in the prologue, Eloise and Lincoln Jackson and the three girls. Would you read from the prologue to give our listeners an idea of where we begin with this story?
Okay. Ariadne, my given name, the one that's on my driver's license, is the sort of name that you're supposed to grow into. It was my mother's idea. Her parents underestimated her when they called her Eloise, a name that had strained at the seams before she was old enough to spell it. Our mother's gifts to the three of us were lush, extravagant, roomy names, names that fit us like oversized coats trimmed in seed pearls, gold braid, and the hides of baby seals. My father had wanted us to have family names with at least one of us girls named after his mother, Lula. My mother, who indulged my father in many things, could not give him this. Why, she wondered, would someone in this day and age give a child a name that was so Mississippi? That is not what Dr. King died for. People shook their heads with each pink birth announcement. Teachers squinted at class rolls and said, who ever heard of black people with names like that? Those kids are going to grow up confused.
Mm. My youngest brother was named Brendan, and at the time, that was a very unusual name. And the same kind of thing was said.
You know, parents mean well, and that's about what you have to say for them. They really, especially when you're a baby, no one holds a grudge against a baby. They really mean to name you the best they can.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was named after St. Brendan the Navigator, who Irish-American folks might say was the first European to land in North America. So Brendan the Navigator, so he was stuck with that name. But then later on, Brendan is now a fairly common name.
And, you know, I used to think my name was really unique, but there are at least five other people with my same first and last names. One of them is a guy.
Really?
Yes, he plays football for Florida A&M University.
He is prepared.
So if you Google me, you might get him.
Well, my name I thought was pretty unusual, too, but there are many Celestes
out
there.
Yes, it's a good name, though.
Yeah. Did you think about changing it when you got to college?
No, it was too late. It was just too late. It would have just been one more thing to think about. But I did, when I went to college, when I went to Spelman, you could be popular for a great many things, including you could be popular for being a writer. And that was a big thing to me. I could actually do this thing that has been the thing I've always wanted to do and actually be known for it. So I could be known for my deed. So I could do both.
Yeah. When did you begin to think about writing as something you could do and do it well and you could actually write a book?
Well, I've always wanted to write. It's the only thing I've ever had passion for, even when I was a little girl. I used to write books, and I used to want my mother to have them laminated. And because for me, that was the height of preservation. That was like archival, you know, have it laminated.
Sure.
And she was like, we cannot laminate everything you write. I was like, why not? But it wasn't until actually I was in my mid-20s when I got an opportunity to do a degree in creative writing. And I said, I'm going to try. And if in these 3 years, if I don't come out a writer, because I didn't know yet that I was a writer before I ever went. But I felt like if I don't come out a writer, I promise I will get a sensible job. And so I went there and I studied those years and I worked on leaving Atlanta every day. It was all I did, was all I could think about.
Yeah. Now, was that at Iowa or was that at Arizona?
It was at Arizona State. When I was at the University of Iowa, I was actually in a PhD program in literature because the thinking was that I need to get a degree in literature so I could have a job so I wouldn't starve.
Right.
And I just did something else, and it worked out for me. I mean, I'm really grateful that it did work out. I took a chance, and it worked out.
Yeah. Well, now, tell us about how you go about being a writer and a teacher. Do you write every day?
You know, this first year at the University of Illinois, I couldn't decide if I wasn't writing so much because I was in transition or because I had just finished a book. But my ideal thing is to write in the morning before the phone rings, before anything happens to upset me, and just get in my hour, and then the rest of the day can happen. I find that, you know, you can prioritize it. For me, I love writing so much. People sometimes ask me about discipline, but to ask me how I'm disciplined enough to be a writer, it's like asking someone who's an alcoholic, how do you drink every day? You know, for me, it's just what I do. If I don't do it, I'm unhappy.
Hmm. What are you working on now?
I'm working on a new novel. I think it's going to be called Our Mutual Sister. It's about bigamy, actually.
Hmm.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I decided that if you're a man and you're trying to get your bigamy off the ground and the two families are in the same city, one family has to be completely complicit. That's the only way it's going to work. And so then I was thinking of what would it be like to live your life as a secret. You know your secret. Everyone knows your secret. How would that affect the culture of your family? And so it started growing out from there, and I'm kind of getting into it. I think that it's my new thing, and I just can't tell you how much better I feel every day having a project to work on, because whenever you're not writing, you have this kind of irrational fear like, is this it? Maybe I'll never write again. So whenever something else comes to you, like, oh, I still have it. It's still here.
Whew.
Yeah.
Those stories that you wrote as a youngster, as a girl, that you wanted your mom to laminate, what were they all about?
Oh, all kinds of stuff. Space travel was a big thing of mine. I wanted to go to Mars. I wish I had wanted to go to a planet that got a little less press, like Pluto. But I wanted to go to Mars. I would write stories about my future as a hairdresser. And when I was in college, I used to write serial stories to impress this girl who sat in front of me. I wanted her to be my friend. And so I would write these stories about our classmates. You know, I'd give her a couple more pages every day because it was something I could do. I was so much younger than my classmates. I finished high school when I was 16. I was so much younger that I couldn't quite fit in. And this was the thing that I had that I could do.
Yeah. What set you off on that trajectory of going through school so quickly?
That is all Barbara Ann. That's my mother. That is 100% Barbara Ann. You would have to call her up and ask her.
What's her number?
I'm not, no telling what she would say. You need to be careful with mothers. You cannot have your mother on live radio.
Well, next time you're on the show, when you got the next book out.
Yeah.
We'll give her a call ahead of
time. Well, you know, I actually sometimes I have a blog on my website, which is tayarijones.com. And once on my blog, I blogged about my mother. I had links to her pictures.
Still there?
It's still there, yeah. If you go to my blog and you do a search for my mother, you'll come up with a story about me and my mother. It's about my childhood embezzlement. I used to be an embezzler when I was a child.
Really?
Yeah, you have to go to my blog to see. But yeah, I embezzled up to almost $3 once at a dime at a time. And because my point with this was that when writing children's voices, you have to remember that children have the same ambition and impulse as adults. And so on my 8-year-old landscape, embezzling this $3 from my parents, one dime at a time, it took me over a month, was the same impulse as corporate greed, but it's just that I didn't have any power. So when you write children, you have to try to think, look at something. One exercise I have my students do is look at something really adult, like romantic jealousy, and then say, okay, how does that play out in a 6-year-old world, et cetera? Because every impulse you have now is the same as an impulse you had as a child.
Yeah. I remember my grandmother had a piggy bank for me. And it was always on my mind when we went to visit her. It's like, how much money is in the piggy bank?
See, yeah. It's just that, and you look back on it as an adult, you think that's cute. But imagine if there was a grown person coming to someone's house eyeing, you know, doing appraising everything in the house. That's shady.
Yeah, what have you got for me? Yeah. No, that's just not so good, is it? You know, you read from the outset of the Untelling a bit of the prologue. In that same prologue, we have this horrible accident that takes place, and it's sudden and it's horrible, but that instant feels like forever. Would you talk about the process of capturing time and making that scene?
Well, one thing I do when I write, I tell my students this a lot too, that writing is like doing topiary, and you don't grow a shrub in the shape of a dinosaur. You grow the big fuzzy shrub and you trim it back to the dinosaur. So I really overwrite. I write every detail or thought that comes to my mind, and then I go back and prune it to the ones that work for me. I think a lot of times students look at short, really short pieces, and then they try to write a really short piece, but you usually have to write a lot and pare it back. And that was the process I used with this. This prologue now is 11 pages, but it was originally about 30, and I had all kinds of extraneous information. And then I just picked the things that really bite. You know, like, for example, the red velvet cake was one thing of many items they had in the car. But when I pared it back, I left only the cake because I loved it so much. It worked so well. But I could not have come up with the cake if I had been censoring myself. So I just kind of let it all hang out and then prune it. Because I don't know what's in my head until I write it all out.
Yeah. Now, do you start and work in a linear way?
I try to, but I don't encourage other people to. I tell people, do whatever works for you and assemble it however it works. I do normally write in a linear fashion. And lately I've been doing this weird thing where I write half a scene, like right up to like the good part, like someone will say, you know, like, unhand that woman. And then I'll stop writing until the next day. So it's like I do cliffhangers to myself.
So you can't wait to get back to it?
Yeah, and then I get back next morning. I'm ready to write the next thing. And I have all day to ruminate over what happens after, you know, the crucial thing. Unhand her. Then all day I'm like, okay, so now what? And then I write like that. It's been working really well for me. I don't know. It feels terrific.
Yeah. Do you dream about your...
I don't sleep very much when I'm writing. I've just started a new project, and so I won't really sleep very much for the next 3 years. I can't sleep. It keeps me up.
Yeah.
I go to bed late, get up early. I don't know. It takes over, but it's okay. You know, everyone has to be taken over by something. I'm just grateful to be taken over by this.
Yeah. Well, I hope we'll talk with you again when you're finished with this latest takeover project.
I'm so lonely when it's over. I'll probably be like knocking at your door begging you to talk to me.
Well, you've been on this tremendous book tour. Is that now come to a close?
Well, no. I have Chicago coming up, and then I have other events. Like if you go to my website, I have appearances. I'm pretty much on the go until January.
Schools. Oh, really? Okay. Well, and your website can be found at
www.tayarijones.com. and it's a link to contact, and I answer all the emails I receive.
Okay, very good. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Tyree Jones is an assistant professor of English at the University of Illinois. At Urbana-Champaign, she is the author of the novels The Untelling and Leaving Atlanta, both books published by Warner Books. The Untelling is the latest, the second of her novels to date. Thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Tyree Jones. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Thank you very much, Celeste. Indeed, the prices are in today, and a lot of red ink at the Chicago Board of Trade, as well as the Chicago Mercantile Exchange today. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars. July wheat, a high on the day of 327, a low of 322, settling 323.5, down 8. September, a high of 337.5, a low of 331.5, settling 333.25, down 8.25. December, a high of 347, a low of 342, settling 343.5, down 7.25. March, a high of 356, a low of 351.5, settling 353.25, down 7.25. July corn, a high of 222, a low of 216, settling 217, down 7.5. September, a high of 231, a low of 225, settling 225.75, down 7.5. December, a high of 238, a low of 234, settling 235, down 6.75. March, a high of 246, a low of 242.25, settling 243, down 6.5. May, a high of 250.5, a low of 247, settling 247.75, down 6.5. July, a high of 255, a low of 251.5, settling 252.5, down 6. July oats, a high of 138.5, a low of 137, settling 137.75, down 2. September, a high of 144, a low of 142.25, settling on the low, down 2 on the day. July soybeans, a high of 678, a low of 664.5, settling 668.5, down 16.75. August, a high of 679, a low of 666.5, settling 670, down 16.75. September, a high of 680, a low of 667, settling 670.25, down 18.25. November, a high of 681.5, a low of 668, settling 672.5, down 17.25. January, a high of 682, a low of 669.5, settling 673, down 15.5. March, a high of 677, a low of 664, settling 667.5, down 15.5. July soybean meal, a high of 214.30, a low of 210.60, settling 210.90, down 470. August, a high of 214.50, a low of 211, settling 211.10, down 480. July soybean oil, a high of 23.30, a low of 22.62, settling 22.93, down 57 in the August contract. A high of 23.38, a low of 22.72, settling 22.98, down 60 on the day. With all that red ink on the Chicago Board of Trade today, it's probably a good thing that we have rather Dan Zwicker of AgriVisor Services out in Bloomington, Illinois, to discuss the markets today. He's one of the leading technicians and probably can give us a handle about what these prices mean in terms of both the near term as well as the farther out picture. Price is also in on the Mercantile Exchange, Celeste, and as I alluded to earlier, red ink there too.
Yep, a second day of red ink at the Merc here this week. Let's take a look at what happened today. Here are the prices, the highs, the lows, and the settlements. August feeder cattle, 112.10 the high, 110.85 the low, 111.10 the settlement, that down 70. September, 110.85 the high, 109.70 the low, the settlement 110.17.5, that down 55. October feeder cattle 109.40 the high, 108.50 the low, the settlement 108.92.5, that down 52.5. June live cattle 84.75 the high, the low 84.05, the settlement 84.45, unchanged on the day. August 83.65 the high, 82.77.5 the low, the settlement 83.15, that down 40. June lean hogs, 71 even, the high 69.45, the low. The settlement, 69.80, that down 165. July, 70.40, the high 68.35, the low. The settlement, 69.15, that down 115. August, 69 even, the high, the low 67.65, the settlement 67.82.5, that down 182.5. October, 59.80, the high 58 even, the low, the settlement 58.72.5, that down 110. July, belly 71.17.5, the high, the low 68.67.5, the settlement 69.60, that down 207.5. The Dow is up 1.5 at 10,551. The NASDAQ up 6 at 2094. The S&P 500 up 1 at 1204.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Coming up tomorrow afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, we will join National Public Radio for an interview with Bill Clinton. Mr. Clinton will be interviewed by Neil Conan live at 106. I do believe they'll be taking telephone calls as well. That's tomorrow, Friday, June 3rd, here on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. We will stay with NPR for the duration of that interview. It will be an hour long, beginning at 106. Slightly shorter than an hour long. And so as we will stay with NPR until 1:59, the settlement prices tomorrow from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange will move into the closing market report. By June 30th, we must meet and exceed our $850,000 member support goal. As of today, we have raised $718,500. Your help now will make a difference. You'll put us over the top. Please call 217-244-9455 and make a credit card contribution. We accept MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and American Express. Help us meet that goal. Help us exceed at $850,000, the member support goal. That number again, 217-244-9455. Thanks.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
A letter from down under, Dr. Science. Stick Boy from Perth, Australia writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I am 6 feet four and weigh only 140 pounds. I've tried everything, but I can't gain weight. What do you suggest?"
Have you tried lead supplements? They come in a variety of flavors. My favorite, strawberry. Put a little lead on your bones and you'll be impervious to nuclear radiation, in case that ugly problem ever rears its head again. Most Americans would envy you your inability to gain weight. Perhaps you could earn a good living as a liposuction recipient. Use the money you earn to buy lead supplements.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.